Behind every mission, there's a plan. Behind every plan, there's a soldier, training, leading, and getting the job done. This is the Kentucky National Guard's G3 podcast, where we share the stories, lessons, and leadership that keep our guard always ready, always there.
Welcome, hello, to Frankfort, Kentucky, with the first episode of the G3 podcast. This is a first-time trial here, so it's a kind of a big ordeal. We're going to try to run this, and I'm going to try to lay it out here as the host. I'm Sergeant First Class Clay Benningfield, Sergeant B. Some people kind of forget my name, Sergeant Major Stoller. But I'm here today. I'm excited, and I think we're really trying to bring something to the Kentucky Army National Guard that's going to be unique. That being said, we're here with the G3, which is the overall training event that we're all looking at the state level, looking down at the units, and we're all about making sure soldiers are lethal and they have their survivability. That being said, though, we want to implement a different way for these soldiers to learn, and we're coming here today to do kind of a series with the G3 podcast, and this series is going to be called The Fixed Bayonet. Now, this little disclaimer here is going to be, hey, what can we do to train, right? Because I think a lot of things we just saw, we had a government shutdown, funding runs training. With that, a lot of things get canceled. So we have to get creative, and we really want to talk today. We want to talk to those squad leaders, those team leaders, and how does that E5, E6 take in the intent and really get creative to make training happen, especially when drill is at home station, because we all know how those go. So it's very important that we really sit here and really pull out, hey, how do we train at home station and how we do that? One thing that we're going to do is we're going to bring on guests in the next series for this fixed bayonet of people who've been in real life scenarios, people who have been on missions overseas, a state of emergencies. You're going to see that these people were put in these positions to perform. And what we're really going to pull out is not just the story, but we're also going to find out, hey, did this training work for you? And if it didn't, what did you do to fix it? And I think that's what we're really trying to capture here on the G3 podcast. So welcome. I'm glad you're tuning in, and I'm going to jump right into it. So we're going to our first guest today, and he is the one, the only, Sergeant First Class, Jeremy Lowe. Jeremy, welcome to the podcast, man. You got a lot of experience, man, and me coming up here, kind of falling into the position that I fell into, I've really noticed that, you got a lot of answers, man. You got a lot of stories to tell, but not only that, you've been at the national level, being recognized for some of the rescues that you have performed with the Kentucky Army National Guard, and that's huge. So congratulations on that, and congratulations 20 years of active service in August. So when I started, you hit that. Hey, man, that's a big ordeal. Congratulations on that. Big achievement. So thank you for your service on that on my behalf and behalf of everybody else. So there we go. And with that, one thing I want to bring up is one of your biggest accomplishments of other things is one thing we're really going to talk about is that aerial swift water rescue. I think some of us hear about the swift water rescue, especially when you deal with your local fire departments and stuff like that. But the aerial portion of it is something you wanted to hone in on because you're with a medevac unit. And we're going to dive into it, but I want to recognize that because that's going to push a lot of our stories as we talk. You were a Marine. The wars in general, so you push in 2003. You go back in 2005 with the Guards Marine. And then you go to Afghanistan in 2020. Big difference between those kind of those operations?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I would say a huge difference, and also what my role was. My role as a platoon company medic in 2005, and then transitioning into, I was a platoon sergeant of a medevac detachment in 2020 in Afghanistan, so completely different roles and responsibilities.
So, all right, so 68 Whiskey. That's all I want to say. 68 Whiskey, combat medic. But that's where your heart's at. And a lot of people don't know with the G3 is you've really grabbed that program as well. So as assistant training NCO here, you kind of grab different training events as we go, and we're kind of learning, right? But you really took the 68 Whiskey by the neck and was like, I'm running with this, because, I mean, you've done the medic side for a long time, and you really kind of made it your own to an extent, but really teaching and letting people kind of run with their program. In another word, I guess.
So even before I started with the G3, I was working with, to back up, myself and my fellow flight medics discovered a gap, a training gap, is that we were not coming out of COVID and all the mess that that was, is that for medics, we were not training to the best proficiency that we could. And with COVID, where we couldn't be in contact with each other and having all the distances and everything else, it's hard to train as a medic if you can't touch and feel and examine patients and practice those skills in your life-saving interventions. So coming out of that in the following years, regulations started to change, the training guidance from HQDA changed, and so we just really saw a gap. And so I approached the G3 along with some other flight paramedics, and so we kind of pitched an idea of like, we want to take over the state 68 whiskey program, which had kind of died as far as a training program. We started outsourcing to other states and sending our people abroad, and we thought we could do a better project and provide a better product, even cheaper. And so they kind of believed in it. And so, like I said, I was still with aviation, came over, pitched the idea, they put money toward it. And in 2022, we had our first class. We wanted to keep it going. So we've taught, we'll be on our fourth class this February that we're teaching, and it gets better and better.
Just keep going.
Yep. The students were blown away with what we were able to do with such limited resources. And every time we've taught the course, we get a little bit more.
Right.
But along with that, we reached out to other people that are passionate about medicine, and so we reached out to local EMS departments where we had friends, local fire departments that we had friends, and they just volunteered their time to come out and see what we're doing. And so they got excited. And so using our local partners, and again, this goes into how we started doing Swiftwater Rescue from helicopters. We had to lean on our partners with fire departments, EMS agencies, even police departments for that matter, of like, our communities want to help. And there's no better story to tell than we help the guard learn something. They get something out of it. We get something out of it. So, and it reinforces that community spirit that the guard is all about.
Yeah. And I think that's another point is even outside the other MOSs is, I mean, you don't come in and, hey, I'm an infantry on the civilian side. You know what I mean? So that's what makes it another thing unique. These people are coming from all walks of life. You got construction workers, bankers, college kids, plumbers. I mean, you name it. And that's what makes it. And they come in, you get that once a month, you get them, and it's like, hey, we have to focus on training.
We have to maximize every moment that we have.
And with a 68 whiskey, I can't imagine. Because you're like, hey, I was plumbing all week.
Yep.
And that will stitch you up.
And typically
you go
most,
off the
most commanders, because there's such a low-density MOS, most commanders, you know, you go out in the field and I randomly walk into an armory and ask what their medics are training on, and you'll find them sitting over a corner having rectangle time and doom-scrolling whatever social media that they're on instead of getting after it as far as either training themselves or get after CLS training or all service members training with their fellow Joes that are also sitting around not doing anything. And so a lot of when we go out and teach is how to empower NCOs and our junior enlisted of, you may be the only 68 whiskey in your company. So how do you have a conversation with your platoon sergeant, your first sergeant, or your commander of, these things are important too. How do I integrate tactical combat casualty care into the metal training that's going on? Like, how do I integrate this into without taking away the commander's time? The commander and first sergeant have such a limited time to be able to train what they need to train. Medical skills are also important. How do I make and mash that together? And so a lot of times we'll give them training strategies about how to approach that conversation, how to get involved in the planning cycle to be able to find that little bit of white space where you could really make a difference.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, especially with the 68 whiskey side of things. But let's push on into a big part of your success, and that's being in the aviation, that medevac. So you're in the flight medic field, right? And with that, where the start was, from what I'm gathering, was like about 2015.
Yes.
We really started looking at that Swift Water Rescue, the aerial version of it. And what caused that? Like, dude, because I don't know anything about aviation, and there's going to be Joe's listening, don't know anything about aviation. What's it take to be a flight crew, I guess? So you got a pilot, right?
We got a pilot to fly. So in late 2008, I got the bug that I wanted to be back in the Guard. I want to finish out my time and get my 20 as a traditional M-Day at the time. I was working full-time with the fire department, but I missed what I used to do. I love the Marine Corps. I loved what I did there, but the Guard's something else. And I tell soldiers a lot of times that I don't particularly care for the Army, but I love the Kentucky Army National Guard.
Yeah.
Like, I love every minute of it. I love Guard soldiers.
Yeah.
I've been around every service, every branch of Reserve, National Guard, and active duty of all of them. There's nothing better than a Kentucky Army National Guardsman and their drive and their zeal for what they do and their love of this Commonwealth. And so I really wanted more of that. So my time with the Guard, back-to-back deployments to Iraq, I needed a break, took 3 years off, and then just wanted to come back in. And so you can either attend the Army paramedic course, which is 6 months long down at Fort Sam Houston, or take, I took a civilian paramedic course that took 18 months to complete. And then after you're a paramedic, you'll go to a critical care paramedic course, which is 8 weeks. Mine, I went to Rush University in Chicago. So it's a 2 week didactic course. And then we did 6 weeks in Stroger Hospital, which is the community hospital in South Chicago, and saw
everything.
More combat wounds in Chicago than I did in five deployments.
That's
so
that's crazy.
You'll do that. And then once you're done with all your schooling, you'll come back and then you have a year to progress in the aircraft. So doing RL progression, which is essentially your instructor, your flight instructors and your pilots teaching you how to be a good air crew member and your roles and responsibilities of what it takes to be a part of an Army air crew and the responsibility that it is. And it's a lot of work and it's a lot of time. I feel like once you join aviation, 2 weeks in the summer and 1 week in a month is all you actually get off. The rest of the time you're flying. And you're constantly studying, staying up on your skills as an air crew member, what the aircraft is like, and constantly learning, and you're just, it's nonstop. And especially in a unit like the medevac, which, you know, as a result of all the work that we put in, only increased the training requirements.
Right.
So we just kept asking questions. And finally, Jessamine County Fire District, and some good friends there in Jessamine County, because I worked in Nicholasville, had good friends that worked over on the county department, and they had tons of resources, and good friends of mine, I started asking questions, and their chief, I convinced him, and he said, let's go. And so we went and started to develop a training plan of like, so from the ground zero, we had to train rescuers.
So let's stop there. Okay. So when we start building this program, I want to kind of, let's take a break real quick. Let's jump into a break. When we come back, I really kind of want to get into where that program took off at, really focusing on it. And when we jump back in, we'll take off from there. And I really want to examine this helmet too while we're at it.
So you can wear it.
All right, let's do this. So we'll be back with Sergeant Lowe. Welcome back to the G3 Podcast, your favorite platoon sergeant here, Sergeant B. We're going to give a shout out to the sponsors here. We got the United States government calendar for your needs, because we all know why we use them, and what is it? Those red number days, right? We want to know when those federal holidays come up. It's going to hang up in your pretty office. We're glad they're on our side, and I think you see these in every local armory. So shout out to United States government calendar. All right, going back. So we're back with Sergeant Lowe here, the G3 Podcast. We've talked about a lot already, but I won't touch this helmet. Can I put this on? All right, so this is your helmet that you've had for how long?
Since I joined, so.
So you've had it the whole time?
2009.
Yeah, I'm about to feel the real deal. I don't care. So this is what a flight crew member gets. Does everybody get one tailored?
Yes, it's fitted to you. So
you have it. Oh my, I can't hear anything. How's the visor work? Help me out. I didn't even play with this thing. All right, so I already feel it, man. You feel important with this thing on. So air crew members, they all get this helmet. High speed, I know somebody's dropped the line. Get to the chopper, you ever said it? Be honest.
We have.
Yeah, that was, and if y'all didn't know, that was dead on Arnold Schwarzenegger. But yeah, this is awesome. Yeah, this is legit. So, is this like, all right, let's do a little sidetrack. Music.
Cyclist.
I know what music you love. On your deployments, did you ever get into like some music where y'all run them through your comms? Let's be honest.
So no and yes at the same time. So much later, I got a device that I could, it's a Bluetooth device I could hook in between my helmet and the communication system of the aircraft that connects to my phone. So the intended purpose is when we go on rescues, I can make a phone call and talk through my helmet to ground rescuers. So if somebody's on the ground and we're coming in, and I used it more than a few times, I could make a phone call and talk to them to get us closer to the area. But then also, yes, I would also listen to my
for those that are
death metal.
Yeah, just listening and not watching. I just put on Sergeant Lowe's flight helmet. It's part of the crew. Talking about music, we all know it. We all know, even on Moebs and stuff, like, did you ever, like, fall back into some music that you just totally don't listen to now?
Oh, no, I'm a metalhead.
I mean,
I'm a pure metalhead.
But that is the morale. I would totally hook some kind of bebop up to this and just be jamming. Yeah. So, all right, enough said with that. Let's get back on track. There's my ADHD kicking in. All right, so we were talking about the Ariel Swift Water Rescue. Shout out to Sergeant Parker. Mm-hmm. I did get to meet him. Great guy. He, at that time, what was y'all's ranks? Do you remember? Are we all E6s?
I was E6 and he's an
E5. Okay, so we got a staff sergeant and a sergeant. So there you go. We got the squad leader, team leader. So perfect what we're talking about. And y'all had this concept, right? We have the equipment. Might not have the funds, but we have the equipment.
So we didn't even have all of the equipment. So okay. We had helicopters, right. We had rescue hoists, and motivated crew members that wanted to do this. And so there was a moment where we came up with a pretty good plan. We had briefed the commander mm-hmm. about it, and then it was, let's talk to the team and see what the team thinks. And the medevac's a pretty small unit, you know, 30, 35 people. Pulled them in a room, showed them some videos of, like, this is what other states are doing. I think we can do this, and they were sold. And so we said, okay, part of that plan in thinking about this and how to relate this back to the young E6, E5 that really wants to get after training, it's not just in the planning, it's also a real hard look at yourselves and where you are as a unit or a team. And so that was the hard look we had to take of, like, we're not good enough yet. Mm-hmm. So we start at square one, back to the individual tasks, the base tasks of how we need to be better at flying and all of our individual crew tasks. And so that was where we started in 15 is go back to basics, get really good at those. Right. We had an AT scheduled at Muscatatuck. Training area up in Indiana, and they have a flooded village, so it's 6 or 8 houses in a pond, and they're on stilts.
And this is set up for this event?
Well, it's set up for water rescue or water training, and so Homeland Security up in Indiana and Department of Emergency Management in Indiana, they use that area a lot. We knew it existed, and so we had set up that was going to be our final training objective and our proof of concept that we could do this. And so then all through 16, we're practicing these skills in open fields, like not even hoisting to a tree. It was in gigantic open fields where there's no risk to anybody. Yeah. We're practicing hitting an X we painted with fluorescent paint in the middle of a field. Can you get me on that? And then we would make the target smaller and smaller, and then we parked our pickup trucks, GSA vans, things like that. Can you put me on top of that? Yeah. Can you hoist down and do that? And it's
Blackhawk.
Yeah, basic, you know, we just kept pushing the level just a little higher, a little more complex, more victims, more complex environments, and then how do we react to that? Right. And we weren't always successful, you know, and about every time we would do and try 2 or 3 things, something would go terribly wrong. And I don't mean terribly wrong, like somebody fell out of the helicopter, but something would be like, we couldn't communicate. All right, stop. Everybody back up. Let's fix that problem. Yeah. Why is that not working? Yeah. Or hand and arm signals. Why aren't you understanding me? The tape that you see on my helmet, that was a later invention of what we figured out. When you put somebody down in a rescue environment and they're fully camouflaged, and you can't see them anymore. And so my hand and arm signals, he can't see because my gloves are green. And now my helmet is black, brown, depending on what version of helmet you have. And so we put a fluorescent taped cross on it and started using head signals to tell the hoist operator, who could be 150, 200 feet above you, you know, if I'm nodding my head up and down, he can see that as opposed to just my camouflaged body disappearing in the environment. Right.
So, and rewriting the SOP, per se. Y'all were doing it right there. Yep. So, I mean, you're building your own training plan. So, and that's, I mean, right there, just those little techniques that y'all are doing and just going back to the basics but building yourself up, it's no different than somebody in a Humvee, right? I mean, it's your gunner, it's your troop, you know, commander, your TC, all that. They all got to work together, your driver, and that's where those hand and arm signals came in. And that's where, you know, knowing how to fill a radio, just basic stuff
that when you put all those problem sets together, in a environment where you have an objective. Mm-hmm. So just to take this back to just a convoy from point A to point B to drop off troops. If your radios fail, You can't talk to QRF or security or an aircraft. Now, if you throw in an IED to just go back to the GWAT or a combined arms attack and you take casualties and you can't talk to anybody, how are you getting help? How are you, you know, everything starts to fall apart. So having that base fundamentals of all of the skills needed to get you, you don't even have to overcomplicate it. But can you do those things? If you can do those really well, well, then make it more complex. Yeah. Add more things into it and keep pushing the training envelope. So in this case, it went all the way up to 2016. We spent an AT. We spent the first week training in that environment, putting people, and we took fire department with us. They went up there, and we had boats in the water for safeties, put people on these rooftops, and then went out and did it. And one of the first things we discovered in a practical environment is at the time we were doing really low hovers, around 30 to 50 feet. And at 30 to 50 feet, I will rip every shingle off a roof that exists with a UH-60 Blackhawk. Okay. And so we de-shingled every roof they had at Muscatatuck. And before we left, I had to go and buy a bunch of bundles of shingles to give to Muscatatuck to re-shingle all of their rooftops. And so one of the things we had learned and is that high hover, and so just you're gonna make mistakes and it's okay.
Right.
Put stop gaps in place to ensure everybody's safe, but then as you make the mistakes, go back and be like, okay, this isn't gonna work. Right. And so as we started to do it, low hovers don't work. Not only are you creating a bunch of damage, but now you have flying debris that's dangerous. And then also what we found out is we would put our own people as the victims, and then we were damn near blowing them off rooftops into the water. And so like, okay, low hovers aren't the thing. We need to be much higher. And so then we were like, okay, 100 feet is a much better area. We're not creating this hazardous environment down there. And it's, and it also makes it a less complex rescue environment. And so we invited all the command up. We invited other departments that had told us no, and this would never happen. We invited them to come see what we did. And we invited, at the time, emergency management to come up and look at it, and everybody went. That's great.
Yeah.
And then the next thing out of there, well, it was wild because it's a helicopter. Everybody thinks
everybody loves
they're amazing.
Guys hanging out of it,
And then I was like, this asset's available to you. Look at what we can do. We just need, you know, a little more training, a little more money. This can be available to yours. And all the emergency people, emergency management told us no. It just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And so that was a big deflate, like a... We took it as a kind of a defeated, but we believed in it.
That's it. That's all that matters.
Myself and Sergeant Parker had many conversations late at night of like, this is gonna be, we're gonna get a call one day.
Yeah.
It's gonna happen.
Right.
We just keep training.
I want that thought to be with every soldier out there, that eventually it's gonna be you.
It's gonna happen.
It don't matter if it's overseas, if you're going to a combat zone, if we're at a state of emergency, whatever.
Somebody's like, gonna call you to do
it's eventually
job.
They're gonna want you to do the job.
Yep.
And you're gonna be that person, like you said, I mean, number one, you gotta believe, you gotta train. But when it comes, are you ready? And that's the whole purpose of, hey, let's not just stand around. Let's start training, right? Go out to the motor pool, figure it out. Go over here in this parking lot. Get out here in the drill hall. There's so many little things that you can be doing to build that team, to build, you know, that cohesion. And then when that time comes, you're going to be as lethal as you can be, and you're ready. And that time's going to come for you, obviously, believing in something that somebody still wasn't going to invest in.
So 2017 was our time. Yeah. We got called to go to respond to Maria and Irma, the two Cat 5 hurricanes that hit the Virgin Islands in Puerto Rico. And so while we got told we're going to go on very short notice, loaded up two helicopters on a C-17 and flew down to the Virgin Islands and started doing search and rescue and did our first hoist down there.
So that was the first one.
It was the first time we ever got called to go do this, but as a result of, in my opinion, of, you know, my brigade commander at the time, the state aviation officer was like, we have this capability, and when the call went out from a territory, we need help. And so we went, and we were very successful.
Yeah.
We did a lot of good work down there, not only doing search and rescue in the first day, but then the recovery after all these injured people showing up to the one local hospital they had in the Virgin Islands, and then flying very critically injured people over to Puerto Rico to a better hospital. But then we're in the middle of that operation when the next hurricane hit.
Just came right behind it.
So we sheltered in place, put the helicopters in a giant concrete hangar, sheltered in place, and then as soon as it passed, we were right back to work And we were down there for about a month supporting those rescue operations. And so came home with like, okay, hey, we did it. Look at that. So then it came home, started beating the bushes again of like, we can use this here in the state. And it wasn't for 2 more years, 2019, when we did our first rescue in the state of Kentucky. And we picked somebody up in Red River Gorge, a patient that they couldn't access due to the remoteness of the area. And so we went out there and performed that rescue.
And so we went from hurricanes, first rescue. It's always we're successful. So everything we implemented in our training, we went down, you got called up, you do it, you come back, we're like, hey, we can do this, right? And you still haven't really got any funding as far as the program ain't really still taken off yet, right? I mean, it's going. But
I think an important part of this for everybody to understand, too. So if I took the mission of central task list, the metal tasks of an aeromedical evacuation unit, so a medevac, and I line that up with doing stateside search and rescue, those things match. Mm-hmm. I have to have helicopters. I have to put fuel in them. I have to be able to fly them safely. I have to, rescuers are able to rescue. I can perform medical tasks. I have medical equipment. I have mechanics that can fix things. I have ground vehicle mechanics that can fix things. So I need all those things in a civilian rescue environment and a wartime environment. So that was the important sell of why we were doing this kind of training is I'm only exercising these metal, or this metal, in a civilian rescue capacity.
Right.
So it was a way to continue the training and convince everybody what we were doing was valid because we were exercising both objectives at the same time. And so that was a big selling point of why we were able to go and train for this is that we were still supporting the unit's metal, which is what a commander is charged by the tag to do.
So if you don't know out there, especially, I mean, this is big for AGRs, but the commander, the first sergeant, but the commanders, you know, they got to meet these metal tasks, these mission essential tasks, right? And you look at your metal task for what unit you're in, whether you're in infantry, your logistics, your FA, whatever, aviation. And that's a selling point for a lot of things because they got to mark these off, right? We got to meet these metal tasks. And that's what, you know, Sergeant Lowe's talking about here. And he just grasped the concept of, hey, we can go out and do this stuff and really save lives. But guess what else we're doing? We're meeting the metal tasks. And that's huge.
How do we train creatively? How do we continue to train outside? So if you're an NCO in this organization, you know that your training never stops and that your learning never stops. And that if you're only training on the weekends, you're doing a disservice to your soldiers.
Right.
And so my NCOs, my flight paramedics and I, and the crew chiefs and the pilots were taking classes on our own time.
Yeah.
We were attending courses on our own time. We're reading books and watching videos about how people do different techniques in rescue, different techniques in taught by firemen and taught by EMS agencies.
Yeah.
And so how do we continue to push outside of drill. And, and I think that's important for everybody is that if you're an NCO and you want to stay and be the best NCO, you have to have the knowledge to be able to teach your people. And that doesn't come from just showing up
100%
on drill weekend.
And you know, a lot of that is, like you said, even taking the classes online or what, online. I mean, we all got a device in our hand at this point, let's be honest. And you can get ideas off your phone, you know, and it comes, you bring it to drill and say, hey, well, this looks like something we could use.
Yep.
This will make us more efficient. This will make us, and in your case, I mean, obviously saving somebody's life, you know, somebody's life is going to depend on it. And eventually it might be your battle buddies. It could be a civilian, it could, you know, many different things. So all that, you know, being said, that's, to me, has been what's important I've seen for you and what's pushed that program because start at the ground level, we go work hurricanes, it works. And then you come back here and you're saving people in your own home state now and being utilized. Now people, a little bit of the belief is coming in, hey,
oh yeah.
This
so then
work,
it becomes a, it started to become, okay, this asset is out there. And so we were having meetings with a lot of our command and emergency management.
Right.
Okay, how do we use this best? It's a scalpel, not an axe. So you can't use a helicopter for everything.
Right.
But in these very small percentage of cases that we have, I can greatly reduce suffering or potentially save a life by gaining quick access to them and pulling them back out and taking them to a hospital or in a waiting ambulance or something like that.
Yeah.
And so the unit was extremely successful at that. And it just, again, pushed training harder and pushed training faster. And so, you know, we just kept pushing the envelope of what more can we do? What more can we do?
Yeah. So let's do this. So before we jump into our big story, We'll take our last break. Let's take a last break here, and we'll kind of regroup. But when we come back, I really want to dive into that 2022 flood. They actually covered this, and it was on an episode. It's called Survival Mode. You can look it up, and he is on the episode. I didn't even know about it. That's how humble you are, number one. When I started up here, I'm up here one day, and I hear everybody coming over to Sergeant Lowe's desk, and they're just like, hey, man, solid, congratulations, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what the hell is everybody talking about? And I remember leaning over, hey, Jeremy, what are they talking about? And you're like, hey, I was on this, I did this a year ago or so or whatever, and they came in, they filmed, and I was like, what? I'm buying the poster. Like, I need that. It's like a superhero sitting here. But it's basically it's a documentary series that they do, and it's survival of different things, tornadoes, floods, volcanoes, train derailments. It's all these scenarios, these real-life scenarios. And sure enough, the Kentucky floods is one of them of 2022. And, it was huge. And so to me, it is huge. But I want to dive into that story. We'll really kind of talk there and kind of round out what's left of the podcast. And I want everybody to hear that story because I think everybody's been anticipating that part anyways. But with the build-up and everything else. So when we come back from break, we'll jump into that. How about that?
Sounds great.
Back, we're going to finish up here with the G3 podcast. We have Sergeant Lowe, my guest. We've already done a bunch. We've built this program of swift water from an aerial, and we've saved people at this point. And then one of the biggest events that's been covered is the 2022 floods in Eastern Kentucky. And I would like for us to kind of go into that. Of you tell the story. And let the listeners really know, like, hey, this moment, we were prepared as much as we could for. And sometimes when you're prepared, it don't work out the best. But you went in and you saved some people that were doomed. Let's be honest, they were doomed. It was the last hope, and you showed up. So let's go into it. So the Eastern Kentucky floods happened. The water you had talked about rise. How many? It was feet.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
So essentially, over what was it? 24 hours, they had 12 inches plus of rain, and we had always trained for flash flooding. So flash flooding is a phenomenon where an area gets hit with an enormous amount of rain, right. Rivers and creeks rise, but as fast as they rise, they go back down. As soon as the rain stops, they go back down. What happened in Eastern Kentucky, that once in a century flood, it hit that amount of rain over that large an area, and then it all gets funneled into the hollers, into the creeks and rivers.
Yep.
And now that's where people lived down there. And so now instead of a couple feet of water, you have 20 plus feet of water, in some cases 30 plus feet of water, and it stayed for a few days.
Right.
So we're not talking 1 or 2 feet of water where, in a couple hours it's gonna go away. Mm-hmm. This took a long time for the waters to recede. Yeah. So when we got that call, we were super fortunate that year. We had done year-round AT, and so a bunch of my air crews just happened to be in that week doing regular flying and hoist training. And so we were just training. I had almost 3 air crews worth of people just on AT orders.
Yeah.
And so that part, kind of just the timing worked out. We got the call early that morning that Eastern Kentucky was underwater and to get ready. We went in, prepped the aircraft, launched for search and rescue operations, and we had 2 aircraft. Staff Sergeant Hunter was the rescuer on the other aircraft. His air crew went, and they were pulling people out of a trailer that was kind of floating precariously. Mm-hmm. And I went over to where we got flagged down with 5 people trapped in an attic. And so with that set down, we had always really trained for breaching roofs, a standard roof, and as soon as I sat down, I hit a metal roof.
Standard being shingled.
Shingled, right. Wooden shingled underlaying.
Wood. Yep.
And so I landed on metal roof, which was a real pucker moment of, there is no way I'm getting through this metal roof. So immediately a lesson was learned that we need
while doing the mission.
Yep. Immediately made a point in my head that we're gonna AR this and I'm gonna have a way to get into a metal roof.
Right. Okay.
And so 5 people trapped in an attic, 20 plus feet of water, and it was rising. A boat crew came by with Chief May from Wolf County Search and Rescue, who are new. So that was a funny encounter of in this wild environment, I just land on the roof that Chief May is already at. And so we came up with a plan because there was a window in the attic they were stuck in, around the corner from where I was at. He was going to ferry the victims over to me, and then we would do the extraction with the hoist off of the roof. And so we had done that 3 times of the 5, and then the boat malfunctions and drifts very quickly down the river and around the bend. I told my air crew.
So it's not just Army equipment.
No. So I radioed my air crew to take the victims we had to the airport, which was up elevated in dry land. And I needed to think about this for a minute. And there's some funny footage we have. My crew chief had a helmet cam and he hears all this. And my pilot was like, he wants us to what? Leave? What's he going to do? And I was like, I'll be okay.
So you're telling him to leave you?
Yes, leave me
okay.
there.
Okay, all right.
While I think about how I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. I called Staff Sergeant Hunter in his aircraft and said, I need Hunter over here with me.
And you're what? You're in this attic?
I am standing on a roof.
You're standing on the roof.
Surrounded okay. by floodwaters.
Right, that's it. You're out there.
Yep.
Okay.
The other aircraft comes over and does a hover, and they put Staff Sergeant Hunter on the roof with me. And then we start to try and collaborate between two of us. How are we going to get these two people out of here? And so I came up with a plan. Big 8-foot piece of webbing and 2 carabiners is what he had. And I inflated my my collar, my personal flotation device. And I was going to jump in the water. And then he essentially slingshots me using the water current into that window. And then once I'm in the window with them, I can get them ready. He scampered up to the peak of the roof over top of the window and would direct the rescue basket down to me where I could load the patient safely and then pull them out.
Yeah, so it's shake and bake, right? You're going to slingshot around. Here we go.
Yes.
And this was all on a whim. Like, yep. Playing here. All right.
Do it right there. And we had a conversation about, like, is this the best we can come up with? And that was the best we had at the moment. And so water was rising. By the time this was said, water is now in the attic. Like, so we have to hurry this up.
Right. So everybody's tracking. Sergeant Lowe, and who was the other one?
Staff Sergeant Hunter.
Hunter. Sergeant Hunter. They're on this roof. There's people trapped in this attic, and it's filling up with water.
Yep.
Like, and fast. We got to make a move. We're going to do this slingshot trick here. So we plan all this out. So, all right. I just want to make sure everybody's tracking. All right, let's go for it.
I pulled it. Inflated the device, it inflated, and I was like, see, this is a good sign, this is gonna work. Kind of joking with him. We have terrible, terrible dark humor between us, and I just jumped in the water, and he was like, all right, here we go. And I kicked out into the current, and it was perfect.
Textbook.
I slid right into that window, kind of said hi to everybody, and I could hear Hunter climbing up, and then I heard the helicopter hover, he's directing them.
Current, was it unbelievable?
It was pretty, floodwater, yeah, it was. It was not like whitewater fast,
right.
But it was pretty quick.
Yeah.
And you're jumping into floodwater, which is every contaminated thing you can think of is in that gross water. Mm-hmm. I get in there, make contact with the 2 remaining victims. The basket comes down, I put one in, goes out, kind of hanging on to the other, because by this time I'm tiptoeing, I'm in floodwaters, and I'm starting to actually float.
Right.
Second time basket comes down, toss him in, and out he goes. And then I just kind of, there was this like surreal moment where I'm just kind of floating in an attic waiting on my turn to get pulled out. And I kind of poked my head out and looked up at Hunter, and I was like, see, I told you it would work. And we kind of had this laugh. And then he lowered the hook down to me. I got out and kicked out from the attic window, got pulled out. And then we lowered the hook and pulled him off the roof. And then we flew back to the airport. Let those people off.
Yep.
I was changing my collar and got a signal from the air crew. I walked back on. They were like, hey, we got to go. We got more. And I was like, let's go.
Yep.
We hit the air, and as we're en route to one, we get a call that there are people trapped in trees. And this was where the episode that we filmed catches their story. But from our perspective, state police was in the air. We had our helicopter. But multiple reports that there are people stuck in trees. And so.
And that was a nightmare to you.
Yes. So when they said stuck in trees, I have this other flashback moment to one of my trainers and a longtime friend, Chad Greathouse, who is a world-renowned instructor in Swiftwater. And he had said to me one day that we needed to train on pulling people out of trees. And I didn't think it was a worthwhile avenue, because in flash floods it'll be the lower branches that they're on,
right.
And then the water's going to recede relatively quickly. And so I just kind of was like, yeah, like, let's think about that. And then just kind of moved on toward other training. And then they said people are stuck in trees. And
flashback.
I had this moment, and then I started kind of chuckling to myself and was like, well, let's go look.
Yeah.
And at least we knew it was like, see. So we flew to the first one. He was in an eddy, which is a slower portion of the current, off to the side, and kind of positioned ourselves over top of him. We were probably 200 feet above him. It's hard to tell what shape he's in.
Yeah.
But it looked as if he was just hanging onto a tree. And I was like, okay, it doesn't seem that bad. You know, we can do this. So my kerchief puts me down right next to him, and I sink to probably my waist, a little higher in water. And then I look, and he's not hanging on. He is hugging the tree, but his foot is caught in the crook of a tree, right, about 4 foot off the ground. And he's a pretty big guy.
Yeah.
And so he had been stuck hanging by his foot, and he's holding himself up out of the water. And so I managed to twist his foot and kind of push him up, got his foot unstuck, grabbed him, put him on the rescue seat, pulled him up, got him in the aircraft. He immediately collapses. He's just ice cold. He's hypothermic.
Right.
Flew him to the airport, got him offloaded. We started warming him up. EMS is coming on the way to him to pick him up, and right back out we go for the next one. So jump back in the aircraft. We take off looking for the next customer, and we get a call for another one stuck in a tree. And I was like, okay, let's go look at this one. I did it one time. How hard could it be?
Right.
And
first time went pretty good.
Yeah,
first time went pretty good. So you're already like, all right, I'm a pro at this.
Yeah, I'm great at
tree
rescues.
Bring it on. I got it. All right.
I'm one for one tree rescue right now. Flew to the next one. She was 8 to 10 foot off the top of the water on a big branch. So now this complicates things, because now my crew chief is 200 feet above, has to lower me to a point in space he can't really judge distance that far,
yeah,
from above, at a point in space, and essentially kind of swing me under the canopy to where she's at. So they're doing, this is where that air crew training comes in, of like, we all acting as one. He is the eyes and ears and working the cable. The pilots are piloting the aircraft, talking on radios, and so everybody's
right,
fully team focused. And then I really have the easiest job, and I'm just kind of hang on like a dope on a rope and just wait for them to swing me into spot and try to do.
Coming in like Batman. Here we go. All
right. But going down to that, I'm like, this is going to be a rough one, because I don't, yeah, it's hard for my crew to figure this out. So I'm trying to communicate with him. Radios are always a problem, and radios in and out, hand signals, everything I can do. He gets me essentially underneath her. So she's, I'm looking at her, her feet are about eye level to me, and there's a branch, and I hang on to it with one arm and kind of hold myself there. And this is about as best as I can get.
Yeah.
I have the rescue seat attached to me. I put the seat out, and I was like, honey, you just got to jump. And she just kind of looked at me and was like, there's no. And I was like,
terrified.
We are coming out of this together. I got you. Come at me. And about that time, he actually picked me up a little bit more. I don't know if the aircraft moved or he picked me up, but I came a little higher. And so my arm is right on this tree branch, and she's about right here. But the rescue seat is probably 2 or 3 feet below her. And I was like, you just have to trust me and come. And she swung her leg over and slid off and hit me. And I just grabbed her and held on. And we were bear hugging us, both of us, to death. Like, because normally you have a safety strap that we rig around the patient to hold them to the seat. But I didn't have the opportunity to do that because of the positioning was.
Yeah.
So she just jumped, hit me. We both swing back out from underneath the canopy and then get in the aircraft. And I've never held on to something harder.
Because she didn't have a safety strap
at
all the whole way up.
She's on a seat, a single piece of metal about this big in between her legs.
Right.
And she just hit me, and I just wrapped up like a monkey on her. And we got her in the aircraft. You know, I take a big sigh of like, as soon as the door closes, I'm like, all right, I can let go of her now.
Right.
Talk to her. We land at the airport. And this was the coolest story I could tell, was we land at the airport. I get her off the airport to take her in to the building. She just breaks down. I've lost everything. Don't know where my kids are. I don't know where my husband is. And I was like, look, we're out getting everybody. What's he look like? I'll see if we can find him.
Right.
She starts describing this dark-haired gentleman that I just picked up. And I was like, is he a bigger guy? Like, a little taller, dark hair, like wearing blue shorts? And she was like, that's him. About the time a family member of hers runs out and was like, they found him, He got him. He's at the hospital. And so they were married.
So you saved the husband and the wife.
Yeah.
And didn't even know.
Two different trees.
Right.
Probably half a mile apart
That's
from each
insane.
Other. And so got her reunited. And we kept going for the next three days. And even longer than that, the rescue stopped after about 3 days and then goes into recovery and assistance. And so we were airdropping water, doing welfare checks for these isolated communities that were just, the bridges were cut off, the roads are washed out, bringing them food and water. And so lessons out of that.
Yeah, so let's bring it in. Yeah. That's a lot to take in, but that, hold on, number one, that was amazing. Once again, that unbelievable, saving people's lives. All the training you did to do it, it paid off, obviously. And sometimes you got to be, once again, you got to be creative. And just that life-saving movement that you did, and we save a family. Like, that's amazing, man. So, but yeah, let's bring it in with what was the lessons learned off this, one of the biggest things you've done right here. So what was good and what was bad?
You have to stay the course in training. Mm-hmm. Like, don't stop at proficiency. Okay, we can do it. It's not perfect. Do it until you can't get it wrong anymore. Like, we have exceeded all the standards on it, and then make it more complicated and keep pushing the envelope. And that's what made us as a unit successful. Our training plan and our commitment to the training plan that we could do this. And again, this was training for a task that is outside of the Army, but you could lay it over top of each other, and we were still accomplishing our missions.
Right.
So in order to prepare for this, we just found a more creative, fun way to do it that could be useful in other applications. So we never stopped. Like, and then know that you're not going to get it all right in the beginning. Like,
right.
It took years for us to be that proficient.
Right.
It took hours and hours and hours of training and screwing it up and back up. What did we learn? What do I need to fix on this? And really looking at yourself and not being like, oh, it's not my fault. Oh, it was because of this. Owning the mistake, how do we correct it as a team?
And I love that point, actually. Not only, hey, perseverance, we got to keep going, but we always say it too. Hey, training is, there's a reason we're doing it. Fail. This is the time to fail, because there's going to be a time we can't fail. We got to make it happen. But I love the fact that you were like, hey, if we fail, that's fine. Let's regroup. Try it again.
Yep.
You know, and I think that's what a lot of people think when they go into a training event, whether it's gunnery or whether, you know, it's a resupply, whether it's shooting rockets, shooting bullets, whatever. It's always, I got to be perfect right off the bat. That's not the case. It's never the case.
No.
Even sports teams, it's never the case. Practice makes perfect, as they always say. So it's like, I think that's some of the best advice is you're going to fail. Accept the failure.
Yeah. Take
what
it on
I
the chin.
Better? Yeah.
Hey, we're going to do this better. I know we can do this better. I just have to train more.
Yeah.
And a very real look at yourself of like, is this my fault? Am I gaining all the benefits for all the training I did not put toward this? Or are the hours I did not put toward this? And that's the reason I failed is because I didn't put the effort toward this to be better.
Right.
You know, none of us are born. I wasn't born with a gift for rescue. We trained for years on that, years and years. We trained harder than everybody else, and that's what made us very successful as a unit, is that we were training specifically for this, and that time came and we were ready, 100% ready. So that was the biggest thing I'd take away from this. And then even after, you know, what did we learn? We need to train on tree rescues. That was a very clear gap of like, I was not prepared to have to tell somebody jump and hope she was going to jump far enough to hit me, which essentially she was just dropping.
Right.
But
it seemed like a mile.
Right.
It had to be seemed like a mile. Let's be honest here.
And then no, I was going to just cling to her for dear life.
Yeah.
And so out of that, what did we learn? We need better equipment. Mm-hmm. I need a piece of equipment that bridges that gap that we found.
Yeah.
I need to be able to cut into a steel roof. And so even after, you know, what was pretty significant success, there were still things we learned out of that that were our failings. And like, I hit a roof that was metal and I did not anticipate that.
Right.
And I have no way to get into this. I was not ready to rescue people out of trees, and I identified a real gap in our equipment. So now we had to, okay, how do we get this equipment?
Right.
And so like, even coming out of that, what do we need to do better? And so we just looked at each other and we're like, okay, hey, good job, everybody. What did we screw up?
And that so true AAR, right into right?
like we could yeah. do this better. I could communicate yeah. better. I couldn't see you. I couldn't hear you. Our radios are trash. How do we get better radios, or how do we make these work better?
Right.
So, again, right back into continuing the training cycle, and they do it to this day. And so, you know, it wasn't shortly after that I got the opportunity to come to the G3, and I wanted to do that, but the unit took, and they're deployed right now, doing amazing things, and they continue to do great rescues in a deployed environment off of that and keep pushing training.
Yeah. That's amazing, man. Number one, thank you for sharing it. I do appreciate it. I know everybody out there listening. I mean, like I said, I want to reiterate, though, that this is Sergeant Lowe. He's human, right? You're a guy in the same uniform that these other Joes are wearing in this organization. And at some point, you're going to get a call. It's going to happen. Can you perform, right?
Somebody's going
to
ask you.
It goes back to you saying, oh, I probably should pay attention during that training.
Somebody's
right?
going to ask you to yeah. do your job when right. it's going to count, no matter what that
no matter
job
what.
Is. And so yeah. are you ready to do your job?
That's awesome. So, well, hey, Sergeant Lowe, thank you for your time. But before we sign off on episode uno, that's one for you Spanish-talking people. That's the only thing I know in Spanish. I never took Spanish. I got a gift for you.
Oh.
So,
is it gummy bears?
Oh, don't. Yeah, it's not gummy bears, unfortunately. But I think it's something you'll kind of appreciate. Let me make sure I got everything here because I had to hide it this morning. So let me set this up. And I think you're really going to appreciate it. It's kind of, we're in the holidays too, so kind of giving spirit. I got you this big old Chinook hawk. I don't even know what kind of helicopter this is. I couldn't get that off. There's Jeremy. I gave you a knife too, man, because I think you really need. I'm gunning for
you're
you.
You're gunner.
Because I always want to ride a helicopter. But I'm gunning for you. You'll probably use the knife on your medical. And as always, look, we got the G3 podcast, the G3P.
I like it.
November 20th of 2025. Man, this is a great Christmas present for you, I thought. And so for you, buddy, hey, man, I appreciate you coming in. But there you go. Hey, man, I appreciate you a lot. So, yeah. So if you're not watching, I just gave him a nice, I guess, Black Hawk GI Joe helicopter with him rappelling out on his hoist and saving people. So, Sergeant Lowe, thanks for today. No, it's definitely been a blast. And then for everybody out there, hope everybody's well. Please, you know, take care of yourself. Take care of your battle buddy. Look out for each other. And with that being said, enjoy life. Be healthy. Stay lethal. That sounds pretty good, doesn't
it? I like it, man.
I like that. That might be our thing. All right. Signing off from G3 Podcast. Out.
Thank you for joining us on the Kentucky National Guard G3 Podcast, where we bring you the voices and stories behind the mission. Stay connected, stay ready, and we'll see you on the next episode.